Story 2. The Adventure of Silver Blaze. Chapter 1. On the Train to Dartmoor. I am afraid, Watson, that I shall have to go, said Holmes as we sat down together to our breakfast one morning.
Go? Where to?
To Dartmoor, to King's Pyland. I was not surprised. Indeed, my only wonder was that he had not already been involved in this extraordinary case. The case was the topic of conversation all across England. It was the strange disappearance of the favorite for the Wessex Cup and the tragic murder of its trainer. I should be most happy to go down with you if I should not be in the way, I said. My dear Watson, you would confer a great favor on me by coming. We have, I think, just time to catch our train at Paddington. We can further discuss the matter on our journey. You would assist me by bringing with you your very excellent field glass. An hour later, I found myself in the corner of a first-class carriage flying along toward Exeter. Sherlock Holmes, with his sharp, eager face framed in his favorite traveling cap, was rapidly reading the newspapers which he had purchased at Paddington. He finally spoke, looking out the window after glancing at his watch. I presume that you have looked into this matter of the murder of John Straker and the disappearance of Silver Blaze?
I have seen what the newspapers have to say.
It is one of those cases that rely more on the sorting of details than on the acquiring of fresh evidence. The tragedy has been of such personal importance to so many people that we are suffering from an abundance of creative ideas, guesses, and hypotheses. The difficulty is to look at only the facts. We must separate them from the ideas of theorists and reporters. Then, having established ourselves on this sound basis, it is our duty to see what inferences may be drawn. We may then discern the special points on which the whole mystery turns. On Tuesday evening, I received a note from Colonel Ross, the owner of the horse. I received another from Inspector Gregory, who is looking after the case, inviting my cooperation.
Tuesday evening? I exclaimed. And this is Thursday morning. Why didn't you go down yesterday?
Because I made a mistake, my dear Watson. The fact is that I could not believe it possible that the most remarkable horse in England could long remain hidden. I thought it would surely be noted soon, especially in a place with so few residents as the north of Dartmoor. From hour to hour yesterday, I expected to hear that he had been found, and that the horse thief was the murderer of John Straker. However, another morning had come, and I found that, beyond the arrest of young Fitzroy Simpson, nothing had been done. Thus, I felt that it was time for me to take action. Yet in some ways, I feel that yesterday has not been wasted.
You have formed a theory, then?
At least I understand the essential facts of the case. I shall list them for you. I lay back against the seat. Holmes proceeded to give me an outline of the events which had led to our journey. Silver Blaze, he said, holds a brilliant racing record. He is now in his fifth year, and has brought in turn each of the prizes of the horse track to Colonel Ross, his fortunate owner. Up to the day of the crime, he was the favorite for the Wessex Cup. The betting was 3-1 on him. He has always been a prime favorite with the racing public, and has never yet disappointed them. Enormous sums of money have been laid on him. It is obvious, therefore, that there were many people who had the strongest interest in preventing Silver Blaze from racing next Tuesday. The fact was, of course, appreciated at King's Pyland, where the Colonel's training stable is situated. Every care was taken to guard the favorite. The trainer, John Straker, was a retired rider who previously rode in Colonel Ross's colors. He had served the Colonel for 5 years as a rider and for 7 as a trainer. Straker always showed himself to be a dedicated and honest servant. Under him were 3 boys, for the establishment was a small one containing only 4 horses in all. One of these boys sat up each night in the stable, while the others slept in the loft. All 3 bore excellent characters.
John Straker, who was a married man, lived in a small house about 200 yards from the stables. He had no children, kept one maid servant, and was comfortably off. The country around is very lonely, but about half a mile to the north there is a small group of houses. These were built by a Tavistock contractor for the use of hospital patients and others who may wish to enjoy the pure Dartmoor air. Tavistock itself lies 2 miles to the west. Across the moor, also about 2 miles distant, is the larger training establishment of Mapleton, which belongs to Lord Backwater. Mapleton is managed by Silas Brown. In every other direction, the moor is completely empty and wild. Only a few wandering gypsies can be found there. Such was the general situation last Monday night when the crime occurred. On that evening, the stables were locked up at 9 o'clock as usual. Two of the boys walked up to the trainer's house where they had supper in the kitchen. The third, Ned Hunter, remained on guard. At a few minutes after 9, the maid, Edith Baxter, carried his supper down to the stables. The supper consisted of a dish of curried lamb. The maid carried a light with her, as it was very dark and the path ran across the open moor. Edith Baxter was within 30 yards of the stables when a man appeared out of the darkness and called to her to stop. As he stepped into the light, she saw that he was a person of gentlemanly bearing, dressed in a gray suit with a cloth cap. He carried a heavy stick with a special top on it. She was most impressed, however, by the extreme lack of color of his face and by the nervousness of his manner. His age, she thought, would be over 30 rather than under it.
"Can you tell me where I am?" he asked the maid. "I had almost made up my mind to sleep on the moor when I saw the light of your lamp."
"You are close to the King's Pyland training stables," she said.
"What luck!" he cried. "I understand that a stable boy sleeps there alone every night. Perhaps that is his supper which you are carrying to him. Now, I am sure that you would not be too proud to earn the price of a new dress, would you?"
He took a piece of folded white paper out of his pocket.
"See that the boy has this tonight, and you shall have the prettiest dress that money can buy."
She was frightened by his manner and ran past him to the window through which she usually handed the meals. It was already opened, and Hunter was seated at the small table inside. She had begun to tell him of what had happened when the stranger came up again.
"Good evening," he said, looking through the window. "I wanted to have a word with you." "What business do you have here?" asked the boy. "It's business that may put something into your pocket," said the other. "You've 2 horses in for the Wessex Cup, Silver Blaze and Bayard. Let me have the straight tip on which is the better, and you won't be a loser." "So you're one of those cheats," cried the boy. "I'll show you how we serve them in King's Pyland."
He sprang up and rushed across the stable to release the dog. The girl ran away to the house. As she ran, she looked back and saw that the stranger was leaning through the window. A minute later, however, when Hunter rushed out with the dog, he was gone. Though the boy ran all around the buildings, he failed to find any trace of the strange man. "One moment," I said. "Did the stable boy, when he ran out with the dog, leave the door unlocked behind him?"
"Excellent, Watson, excellent," said my companion.
The importance of the point struck me as well. I sent a special wire to Dartmoor yesterday to clear the matter up. The boy locked the door before he left it. The window, I may add, was not large enough for a man to get through. Hunter waited until his fellow trainers had returned. Then he sent a message to the trainer and told him what had occurred. Straker was excited at hearing the account. It left him, however, vaguely uneasy. Mrs. Straker, waking at 1 in the morning, found that he was dressing. In reply to her inquiries, he said that he could not sleep on account of his anxiety about the horses. He intended to walk down to the stables to see that all was well. She begged him to remain at home, as she could hear the rain falling against the window. However, in spite of her pleading,
He pulled on his large coat and left the house.
Mrs. Straker awoke at 7 in the morning to find that her husband had not yet returned. She dressed herself quickly, called the maid, and set off for the stables. The door was open. Inside, Hunter was sunk in a state of absolute unconsciousness on a chair. The favorite's stable was empty, and there were no signs of his trainer. The two boys who slept in the hayloft above quickly woke up. They had heard nothing during the night, for they are both sound sleepers. Hunter was obviously under the influence of some powerful drug, as no sense could be got out of him. He was left to sleep it off while the two boys and the two women ran out in search of the missing trainer and horse. They still had hopes that Straker had, for some reason, taken out the horse for early exercise. However, on reaching the top of the hill near the house, from which all the neighboring moors were visible, they could see no signs of the missing favorite. They did, however, perceive something which warned them that they were in the presence of a tragedy. About a quarter of a mile from the stables, John Straker's coat was hanging from a bush. Immediately beyond, there was a bowl-shaped depression in the moor. At the bottom of this was found the dead body of the unfortunate trainer. His head had been shattered by a strong blow from some heavy weapon, and he was wounded on his leg. A long, clean cut had been made on his leg by some very sharp instrument. It was clear, however, that Straker had tried to defend himself against his attackers. In his right hand he held a small knife, which showed blood on it up to the handle, while in his left he held a red and black silk scarf. This scarf was recognized by the maid as having been worn on the evening before by the stranger who had visited the stables. Hunter, on recovering from his unconsciousness, was also quite positive as to the ownership of the scarf. He was equally certain that the same stranger had, while standing at the window, drugged his curried lamb to put him out for the night. As to the missing horse, there was abundant proof in the mud at the bottom of the hollow that he had been there at the time of the struggle. But from that morning he had disappeared. Although a large reward had been offered, and all the gypsies of Dartmoor are on the alert, no news has come of him. Finally, an analysis has shown that the remains of the supper left by the stable boy contain a large quantity of powdered opium. Those are the main facts of the case, stripped of all guessing. I shall now explain what the police have done in the matter. Inspector Gregory, to whom the case has been committed, is an extremely competent officer. Were he but gifted with imagination, he might rise to great heights in his profession. On his arrival, he found and arrested the man on whom suspicion naturally rested. There was little difficulty in finding him, for he stayed in one of those houses which I have mentioned. His name, it appears, is Fitzroy Simpson. He is a man of excellent birth and education who had wasted a fortune at the horse track. He lives now by doing a little quiet bookmaking in the sporting clubs of London. On being arrested, Simpson volunteered the statement that he had come down to Dartmoor in the hope of getting some information about the King's Pyland horses. He did not attempt to deny that he had acted as described on the evening before. He declared, however, that he had no criminal designs and had simply wished to obtain first-hand information. When presented with his scarf, he turned very pale. He was completely unable to account for its presence in the hand of the murdered man. His wet clothing showed that he had been out in the storm of the night before. His stick, which was weighted with lead, was just such a weapon as might, by repeated blows, have caused the injuries from which the trainer had died. On the other hand, there was no wound on his person. Straker's knife seemed to show that at least one of his attackers must bear some injury on him. There you have it all in brief, Watson. Is it not possible, I suggested, that the wound on Straker may have been caused by his own knife in the uncontrollable struggles which follow any brain injury? It is more than possible. It is probable, said Holmes. In that case, one of the main points in favor of the accused disappears. And yet, I said, Even now I fail to understand what the theory of the police can be.
The police imagine, returned my companion, that this Fitzroy Simpson drugged the boy and in some way obtained a copy of the stable key. He opened the stable door and took out the horse with the intention, apparently, of stealing him altogether. The horse's bridle is missing, so Simpson must have put this on. Then, having left the door open behind him, he led the horse away over the moor. Then he was either met or surprised by the trainer. A fight naturally followed. Simpson beat out the trainer's brains with his heavy stick without receiving any injury from the small knife which Straker used in self-defense. Then the thief either led the horse on to some secret hiding place or else it may have run away during the struggle. Perhaps the horse is now wandering out on the moors. That is the case as it appears to the police. Improbable as it is, all other explanations are more improbable still. However, I shall very quickly test the matter when I am once on the spot.